This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Rates of HIV infection are on the rise among gay men and African Americans. In New York City, health officials sound the alarm on a drug-resistant and fast-developing strain of the virus. After a decade of powerful drug treatments, public health officials, gay leaders, and AIDS educators worry that the campaign to fight the spread of this disease may have to become more aggressive. A recent New York Times article listed some radical ideas lurking on websites where men meet, crashing the crystal meth parties that can lead to unsafe sex, and partner notification, voluntary or not. It's a debate that touches directly on the issues of community, privacy, blame, and personal responsibility. Later on this hour, Spain reflects on its own war on terror a year after the Madrid train bombings, but now we want to hear from you. If you're an AIDS prevention educator, what new methods are you considering? If you're HIV positive, are these the right ideas or a frightening direction? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. The latest salvo in this debate was fired not by a court case or a prevention expert, but by a sex advice columnist, Dan Savage, whose Savage Love column appears in weekly newspapers around the country, got an email from a young man struggling with an awkward social dilemma. Dan Savage joins us now from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation studios in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
What advice did this guy want from you?
Well, he wanted to know what to do about a friend of his, a young friend who had become infected with HIV through internet hookups and unsafe sex that his friend was having. And he was watching as his friend turned around and continued to have unsafe sex with anonymous partners that he was meeting online. And he was wondering, what do you do when you have a friend who you suspect or know is casually and maliciously, I would put it, infecting other people with HIV?
And what did you tell him?
Well, I told him that he should have nothing to do with this person. He was wondering whether or not he should out him or to talk about it with other friends or confront him. And I told him he should confront him and then drop him. If he had a friend who was mugging little old ladies or raping people, he probably wouldn't want to be that person's friend anymore, because those are acts of violence. Infecting somebody with HIV, a potentially deadly virus, is an act of violence, and you should have nothing to do with that person. A line has to be drawn. And I also floated an idea in that column that I think that the time may have come for. One of the things that's going on out there is gay men make their choices sexually. Besides the idea that there are drugs and treatments now that are effective and that can stave off or put off indefinitely death or keep somebody with HIV long enough to die of something else entirely, one of the things that's going through people's minds as they make their choices is, for gay men, there's this sort of consequence-free environment where if you get infected, an AIDS organization or a public health agency is going to pay for your HIV medications. And it'll also, if you are infected, pay for the medications of somebody else that you infect. And I thought that, you know, heterosexuals are pretty much free to engage in as much intercourse as they like. And there are consequences, disease consequences also for heterosexuals. But when it comes to heterosexual sex, you know, the biggest, scariest consequence is often children, for people who don't want to be parents. And if you get somebody pregnant, if you're a man out there, you know, behaving irresponsibly, and you get somebody pregnant, the state will come after you for child support payments. And that is in the back of a lot of heterosexual men's minds as they engage in casual intercourse or even anonymous sexual intercourse, which is not unknown among heterosexuals. And it does encourage a certain degree of responsible behavior in some heterosexuals, not in all, of course, and child support payments aren't a perfect system. But it does sober the minds of a lot of people and encourage them to behave responsibly. And I thought, why not drug support payments for guys who casually infect other people? That if you maliciously or negligently infect someone else with HIV, the state should be able to come after you for drug support payments. And it would be very much modeled on child support payments, you know, a percentage of your income that you could afford. And it would introduce into the calculations that gay men make around their sexual choices the idea of a consequence, the idea that it wasn't, that there was, you know, there was some gravity to this and you could be on the hook. And I think even if you could only track down through partner notification or contact tracing a small number of people who had infected other people and garnish their wages for part of the expense that the state is paying, and states all over the country are paying it for drugs for people who are HIV positive, that it would have a real impact on a lot of the seemingly not so gay men out there who are making absolutely not so immoral sexual choices.
What's the reaction been? I mean, it seems like you struck a nerve here.
I'm buried in email, actually. I was just flipping through a few of them before I came on the air. And it's interesting. The reaction from a lot of heterosexuals is very positive, and a lot of people have pointed out that knowingly exposing someone else to HIV is a felony. And the reaction should be, don't go after child support payments, throw them in prison. Interestingly, whenever you hear about someone being prosecuted for exposing someone to HIV, it's invariably a heterosexual relationship. And almost invariably in the United States, it's an African American man having sex with who are having infected or exposed a white woman or a series of white women. And I will let other people tease out the deeper meanings of that. But very rarely are gay men prosecuted for knowingly infecting other people with HIV. And a lot of HIV prevention educators wrote in to tell me, I think rather appallingly, in an indictment of HIV prevention education, a good indication of part of what's wrong with HIV prevention education, and a good indication as to why it's not working very well in the United States, that you can't say that you can't tell HIV positive guys that they are behaving badly, that you're only going to make them feel shame, and it's going to make things worse, it's going to drive them underground, and that you can't punish. You can only understand, and you have to react with compassion. And that, there's a lot of deep underlying issues and torments that a gay HIV positive man may face, and it may be causing him to act out in inappropriate ways. But the correct response is one of sort of compassion and understanding. And I guess I'm a bad gay guy. I mean, I'm a homosexual myself, and but I guess I'm a bad gay guy because I look at other gay guys who are behaving in that way and think that they're incredibly immoral and cruel and vicious. And I have a lot of HIV positive friends who go to great lengths to make sure that they do not infect anyone else and behave in an ethical, responsible manner. And I resent very much having my responsible HIV positive friends lumped in with these men who do not care if they infect other people or who seek to infect other people who are also gay. I think that those men are bad actors and should be called out and should be punished.
You're talking in a broad sense, and one of the other things you talked about was, better partner notification, responsibility, accountability.
Absolutely. And, it's past time that starts to be built into HIV prevention education approaches. Once upon a time, 25 years ago, the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in the United States, there was an argument against partner notification because there weren't legal protections for people who were HIV positive to protect them from discrimination. There also weren't effective treatments. So partner notification then would have meant a tap on the shoulder, hello, here's the bad news, you're going to die, and now you're in incredible danger of being discriminated against, and we'll see you around. An argument could be made and was made then that even if that was the case, hopefully then somebody who had been exposed would know not to infect others, and it would be terrible to be told, but maybe it would change the way you behave and protect other people who were not infected yet. But the people who argued against partner notification then one carried the day. But 25 years later, we're dealing in a very different sort of playing field now, where there are effective treatments, and the earlier you get into treatment, the more effective the treatments are. So the speed with which you seek medical attention after you've been infected matters very much, and there are laws that protect people with HIV from discrimination. So the two big arguments against partner notification are gone, and yet we have an HIV/AIDS establishment that continues to argue that people's private lives, people's privacy has to take precedent over public health. And this is a standard that doesn't apply to gonorrhea, to syphilis, to other sexually transmitted diseases, and even not, and tuberculosis and other diseases where we already do contact tracing and partner notification to get people into treatment and help prevent it. And the time has come to normalize our public health approach to HIV, to treat it like we treat other sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, joining us now is Kevin Cranston. He's at the studios of WBUR in Boston, director of the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Just to get an idea of what happens now in terms of what Dan Savage was talking about, how does Massachusetts handle partner notification?
We actually call it partner counseling and referral services. It's built on the existing system of STD partner notification, which is decades old, and is a critical portion of making available information to individuals about available treatments for a number of infectious diseases. We are currently expanding on that system To include not just the current state staff that perform the interviews where we elicit the names of partners and make contact anonymously to those partners, indicating that they've been exposed to an infectious disease. We're expanding that staff to include individuals such as medical care providers, testing counselors, and case managers who are assisting HIV-positive individuals.
Is your program, are people who are diagnosed with HIV giving these names of their partners voluntarily, or are they required to do so?
It is a voluntary service. We do have strong confidentiality protections in Massachusetts, though those laws are not universal and not in every state. Our system is based on a voluntary, supportive, and consensual approach, but we have been building into the interview process for some very clear examinations of issues of personal responsibility, as well as an opportunity to address the positive person's legitimate concerns about the possibility of having infected other individuals, knowingly or unknowingly.
And just before we go to the break, I wonder if you see any new urgency in more aggressive partner notification, more aggressive means of prevention.
I believe we have to expand the access points that individuals have, and I think we need to make a more intentional effort to engage both newly diagnosed HIV-positive individuals and individuals who have known about their infection for some time to continue the conversation about what are the risks that they may have engaged in the past or may have recently engaged in that has put other individuals at potential exposure risk, but to do that in a supportive and confidential way.
We're talking about new ideas for AIDS prevention techniques. We want to hear from health educators, people living with HIV. What needs to be done? Is there new urgency? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. After 25 years of fighting AIDS with free condoms and public service announcements, rates of infection in some communities are still rising. This hour, we're discussing new strategies to combat the disease. You're invited, of course, to join us. Are tactics like partner notification the right direction or an invasion of privacy? 800-989-8255, our email address, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Sex Advice columnist Dan Savage, and we're also speaking with Kevin Cranston of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And you were describing Kevin Cranston, the voluntary partner notification program in Massachusetts. Is it effective? Does it work?
We have noticed over the years that because of, I think, some concerns about participating in a state system, and perhaps because some medical providers may have overcompensated around some of the confidentiality concerns, that we were not getting the volumes of individuals taking advantage of the system.
So,
and that's why we're expanding it.
You're expanding it, but your problem is people aren't participating.
We're believing that folks would more likely participate if they could work with the individual who's already providing some of their care, someone who they already trust, already have a counseling or medical relationship with, who can be a more active participant in the process.
All right, let's get some listeners on the line. Ron joins us from San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. The thought first came to me when I heard the subject of the show that we're dealing with minors. I work with a group called Hope and Beyond, which is a student service group that has been fundraising for the last 3 years waiting for the FDA approval of the oral fluid, the rapid HIV test that allows for testing in any location with a 20-minute result.
Right.
The students focus on this because they have a realization in service learning that they are sexually active human beings. My consideration for this discussion on partner reporting is, what do you do about the privacy of a minor in that relationship? The gentleman just mentioned about someone that the patient may have confidence in so they could report to. With public records, a young person, there's a great deal of stigma and fear still in this country as well as all over the world on this subject. It's very touchy. How can you do it with the people who are really most at risk, the young, the basically innocent and ignorant young person who steps into sexual activity without a realization? They all know about AIDS. Mm-hmm. They all know what it is. But, you know, youth has a tendency to believe tomorrow's their world.
Yeah. Dan Savage?
Well, I think that you need to look to, I'm not a big fan of always running to the underlying causes, but we do have an abstinence education problem in this country that encourages people to regard being prepared for sex or being educated about sex as somehow being sinful or not a very good person. And is actually, we're seeing STD rates climb as abstinence education programs continue to, in my opinion, mess with the minds of young people in schools. You know, we need people.
A fraction of the situation. Now you're talking about young people who have energy, hormonal, running wild.
Oh, believe me, I know. I get mail every day from young people with hormonal energy pouring out into their emails, and they need information and they need condoms. But I also know that when a young person has access to medical care, which is another part of the problem in this country, is, you know, this is also an access to medical care problem around STD treatments, that when they do have access to medical care, they should seek treatment. And if they have any other sexually transmitted disease besides HIV, they're going to be approached about partner notification and contact tracing, as they should be.
The hidden factor of 10 years and some dormancy from HIV to AIDS and then the new possible strains.
One of the things that's being floated right now and being proposed is that HIV testing become just a regular part of everyone's medical checkups and a regular medical profile, and that there's universal HIV testing, which I, as a gay man, support and think it's past time for that kind of approach.
Ron, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Kevin Cranston wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Kevin Cranston, director of the HIV-AIDS Bureau at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Let's get another caller in. Robin joins us from Washington, D.C.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
It's a very good topic, thank you. I am an HIV-positive middle-aged mom in Washington, D.C. area, and I also work in the legal community. And I have so many thoughts, but I've got to try and think them through properly as I convey them. One of them is, when the gentleman was speaking about equating it to the, you know, the child support and the prescription support, I understand in theory what he was saying, but if you're presented with, you know, an attachment for child support and you go to court for that, you don't get the stigma that you would if you have to argue a legal case about knowingly infecting a person with HIV. That could just ruin somebody's life, and I could see the viciousness going back and forth, and it could be rather contentious, even if that person did or did not knowingly infect that person.
But
having a child and child support is a totally different thing.
Well, we already have laws on the books that make knowingly infecting someone else a felony, which will get you dragged into court, and there will be a legal case made, and will be very contentious and potentially stigmatizing. And it seems to me that a system where people were required to step up to the plate and take some responsibility if they should infect somebody else maliciously or through negligence would be, a great deal less stigmatizing than going to jail for 15 or 25 years.
No, I understand that, but you get an upset lover who wants to then contend, hey, he never told me or she never told me, and then you get dragged into court and your employer knows and your neighbors. I mean, it could get ugly.
That situation already happens around felony charges of assault with HIV in HIV infection cases.
With HIV infection cases.
Yeah. Let me ask, Robin, were you notified?
I was never notified. I have no idea how I became positive. I was married and now I'm remarried, and I let the both of, you know, my husbands know, and they are not positive. I have no idea how I became infected. It obviously was through heterosexual sex. Hmm. And I don't have an issue with that. I have to move on. But I have a very strong opinion about people who do knowingly infect other people, yes, and there is accountability. But I just see it getting very ugly and people running scared, and I could just...
Well,
you have to have a lot of checks and balances.
In the gay community, there isn't a lot of accountability. There is a lot of... You can go to any number of websites and find people who are advertising their willingness to infect other people, and nothing is done about it. There are busts. There are no stings. And it is...
There should be legal ramifications.
It is appalling. Also, on the HIV prevention front for gay men, it is almost impossible to find an HIV prevention educator who will say it is immoral to infect someone else with HIV. It is wrong to knowingly have unprotected intercourse with someone if you are HIV positive and you don't know what their status is, even if they consent to having sex with you. It is wrong. And you can't find HIV prevention educators who will say that to gay men. And part of it is a huge hangover from what AIDS meant 25 years ago. Because once upon a time, having HIV was such a sudden and devastating thing to be told, and you were going to be dead so quickly, there was this attitude and this posture that, well, you couldn't burden someone with HIV with anything, with any more bad news. With certainly you couldn't admonish them in any way. We just had to make things better for them, to comfort them, because they were going to be dead very shortly. And that continues to this day. You can't say anything to an HIV-positive person that is going to make them feel bad, like no, or you shouldn't, or you mustn't, or that's wrong, or that's immoral. And so we have this language of in HIV prevention education that's always about, as the man from Boston was using, about compassion and understanding and not confronting. And the time has come to confront. And most HIV-positive people confront themselves and are very confrontational and very ethical, as I believe the caller indicated that she's disclosed her status to her husband. Most HIV-positive people behave that way, but there's this core group of people who do not and who are fueling in the gay community the HIV infection rates and keeping it roaring along and incubating not only potentially new deadly strains of HIV, but incubating new STDs. We just had a case of a new kind of chlamydia starting to spread through gay communities in the United States, and something has to be done.
Robin, thank you. Joining us now is Evelyn Faust. She's at her office in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's that state's public health department's director of STD and AIDS prevention programs. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There's a partner notification program in North Carolina. It is not voluntary, is it?
No, not in the same way at all that as it is in Massachusetts. However, you know, I agree with Massachusetts. It's a critical piece of public health that has to be there. In North Carolina, when you test HIV positive, you, as part of the counseling that you're given also a set of control measures that by law you have to follow. One of those is to get a TB skin test. Another is to notify your past and your future partners. At the same time that you're being given that and told that that's part of your personal responsibility, you're also told that the state of North Carolina has to offer a partner notification program, and we do, and we can notify your partners for you.
And what if somebody refuses to tell you their partners?
Well, if they refuse to notify their partners, and I just want to state that there are very few people, actually, that we work with that do that. Most of the time when we go to people who've been newly diagnosed with HIV, they may not be happy to see us immediately. There's lots of emotion going on with that. And then, you know, there's huge trust issues with any of these types of programs. But our first job is to get them into care and make sure that their needs are met. And then we offer them an opportunity to take personal responsibility and to get people notified that they're not comfortable doing. And I have to tell you, most people take advantage of that option. But if they absolutely won't, then it becomes a matter of a control measure violation, and we can prosecute them if we can verify that they're having sex with people and not telling them their status.
And has anybody been so prosecuted?
Yes. North Carolina, unfortunately, has had to prosecute people for that.
As I asked your colleague from Massachusetts, are there any studies to indicate that your program is effective in controlling the spread of AIDS?
Yeah, our program was looked at by Centers for Disease Control. We recently, or last year, had an MMWR article from CDC come out about it. But just real quickly, one out of every five partners that we notify are infected with HIV, and most of those would not have known that they had even been exposed had we not been there to tell them that. So we get a very high rate of positivity out of doing partner notification.
And can I jump in here for a second?
Go ahead, Dan.
That's what's so crucial, I think, about instituting partner notification, is the one of five people that you discover who are not aware that they are HIV positive. It's a bummer to be told, but they're not going to unknowingly then run around completely unaware that they're infected, infecting other people. Because now that they know, and now that the state has elbowed them in the ribs and told them they have a responsibility to disclose and to behave in an ethical way, or there may be legal consequences, they are hopefully going to not pass the virus along, which should be our goal in a public health.
Right. And, you know, I just wanted to point out that most of the people that we work with who are newly infected, they're obviously very concerned about their health, but they're also concerned about other people's health. And they use our service because it's just too hard to go back to somebody and talk about this about them being exposed. And particularly if the person who was infected didn't know they were infected, and they want that person to get advantage of care. When we go to people, we say, somebody that cared enough about you to give us your name wants you to know that you may have been exposed to HIV. Please go get tested.
Evelyn Faust, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Evelyn Faust, director of the STD/AIDS Prevention Program at the North Carolina Department of Public Health, joined us from her office in Raleigh, North Carolina. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Gary. Gary's with us from Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Gary.
Hi, thank you. I do respect the guest physician regarding, you know, getting people tested. Ultimately, it sounds as though you just want people to be aware of their HIV status. I, however, feel that the reason that it is on the rise here, particularly in South Florida where I live, and where I found out I was HIV positive, is primarily because people are unaware of their HIV status. And so I was kind of taken aback by his comments about equating it to heterosexual men and then
child support, yeah.
Children, right, because, you know, where would we be if someone came along and took someone to court and said, you know, someone who had no idea at the time that they were HIV positive.
I think the proposal was for people who knowingly infect another person. Would that change your opinion, Gary?
I believe so. To be honest, I wasn't aware that there was such a big issue about this.
It's a huge issue. There are many, many. I would direct you to the internet, I'd direct you to Craigslist, I'd direct you to other websites. There are people out there who know they're HIV positive who are acting in completely immoral and unethical ways, exposing other people, taking advantage of other people. And I have email from them that I've gotten in response to my columns, saying that if someone else consents to unprotected intercourse with them, even without their disclosing, ignorant of their HIV status, that it's not their problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do about those guys? I don't think you're one of those guys, but something has to be done.
No. Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking my comment.
Thanks for the call, Gary. We're talking with sex advice columnist Dan Savage, editor of The Stranger, which is a weekly paper in Seattle. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is John Givner, director of the HIV Project at the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice of you to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been listening to the conversation. What's been your reaction to the two partner notification programs we heard about, Massachusetts and North Carolina?
Well, I certainly agree that partner notification is an important part of public health strategy nationally and preventing the spread of HIV and stemming the epidemic.
We don't have partner notification in Seattle because the HIV establishment in Seattle opposes it.
Yeah. Dan, let him answer the question.
I'm sorry.
Sure. I agree with a lot of things that both Kevin and Evelyn said. Most importantly, I think, is that testing and acceptance of public health messages relies on trust and cooperation among those who are seeking testing. And the most important thing that we can do to prevent HIV transmission in this country is encourage people to get tested, because the majority of new cases of HIV are transmitted by people who don't know they're HIV positive at the time of transmission.
The rate of infection in this country, the death rate from AIDS is down considerably because of the new drugs, but the rate of infection is virtually unchanged, about 40,000 new people a year. Does that suggest that whatever is being done is ineffective?
It suggests, I think, that HIV prevention is complicated. I think there are a number of proven techniques to prevent HIV from spreading that are underutilized or simply not utilized. I'd point as one example to abstinence-only education that Dan was discussing earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, we know as a fact that needle exchange programs and access to clean needles prevent HIV transmission and, in fact, reduce transmission 4 to 6-fold in communities that have needle exchange programs. And yet they're underutilized because of political pressures that simply don't make good public health sense.
But what we're talking about today is it time to put the focus more, I'm not saying don't do all those other things, but more on personal accountability?
Personal accountability, responsibility, these are parts of a big discussion. I think that that everyone on this program agrees that it's everyone's responsibility to be safe, and it's all of our responsibility to ensure that others are safe and to encourage others to be safe.
Can I jump in there?
Not really, because we're running out of time in this segment. So we're going to cool down and take a short break and then come back with both of you. That's Dan Savage, editor, the writer of the column Savage Love, and John Givner of the Lambda Legal Defense Fund. Also, when we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls. Our number, of course, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. We'll also go back to Spain, as that country reflects 1 year after the Madrid train bombings. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about controversial proposals to contain the spread of HIV. Our guests are advice columnist Dan Savage and John Givner of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. And let's get another caller on the line. Mike is with us. Mike's calling from Portland, Maine.
Yeah, I've worked on HIV policy and education committees for different universities around here. And one of the things I learned in Maine is that HIV status is such a protected class in so many ways that it is against the state law for anyone to disclose the HIV status of another person if they learn of it. If someone were to tell me they were HIV positive for whatever reason, and I knew they were going to have sex with another individual, it would be against the law for me to tell that individual that they were HIV positive if that person decided not to.
John Givner, is that common?
It is common, and it's frankly fortunate. A number of states adopted HIV-specific confidentiality laws because the disclosure of HIV status often leads to discrimination, extreme stigma. And while that was certainly true in the early days of the epidemic, it is still true today. Every day I speak with people who have been fired from their jobs, whose doctors have turned them away because of their HIV status, whose friends and family have rejected them because of their HIV status.
It's illegal to be fired for being HIV positive. It's illegal to refuse someone treatment for being HIV positive. There are remedies beyond these idiotic non-disclosure laws that would require me not to say anything to my sister if I knew that her boyfriend was HIV positive and they were not being safe.
Exactly. What I don't understand is that HIV is an infectious disease just like the flu or a cold or hepatitis, yet it's protected.
And that law is a relic from the 80s, from a moment when, you know, Ryan White was burned out of his home, and HIV is not what it was. And there are still instances of discrimination, and they should be prosecuted. But the pendulum has to swing back toward the center, away from HIV-positive people have an absolute right to do absolutely anything, which is part of the problem right now, is this expectation that we're not allowed to treat HIV like any other infectious disease.
John, I want to get back to John. Go ahead.
Sure. I would disagree that the message behind HIV confidentiality laws is that people with HIV can do just about anything. I would also disagree.
Well, just a moment ago, you said that everybody, I mean, and you threw out the mantra of HIV prevention educators, which is everybody is responsible for their own sexual health. And that removes any burden from HIV negative people to their community or to their sex partners, to anyone else. You don't not only have responsibility for your own sexual health, we all have responsibilities toward each other and the broader community's sexual health, which includes holding each other accountable and holding each other to a higher standard and insisting that people behave safely and responsibly, and if they have an infectious disease, that they don't spread it.
I wouldn't disagree with that and the fact, and that is a piece of a large discussion about personal responsibility and public health. I think the danger here is that we slip into the same trap that people have been falling into since the beginning of the HIV epidemic, which is dividing the 950,000 or so people with HIV in this country into those that are innocent and therefore good and those that are guilty and therefore bad.
But there are
bad.
Some people with HIV who are behaving responsibly, and I would call them good, and there are some people with HIV who are behaving in appalling, malicious, vicious ways, and I would call them bad. And I think lumping the good people with HIV in with the bad people with HIV does a disservice to the good people. And part of the problem with only wanting to discuss all HIV people as one large group is that the behaviors of the really, really terrible people who are behaving in terrible ways, who also have HIV, is imperiling services and sympathy for all the HIV-positive people out there who are behaving responsibly, or all of HIV-positive people, period. We have to discuss the bad actors as bad actors and figure out a way to reach them and approach them and stop just talking about HIV-positive people as one monolithic group. They're not.
Excuse me. Just a second, John. Dan, I have to ask you, I know you feel strongly about this. Because of your strong opinions, you have to let John talk. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
No problem. I think that the part of the problem with this kind of discussion is that it focuses so heavily on those extraordinarily few people who are behaving in a very reckless manner or malicious, as you say. I wouldn't deny that a very small number of people behave recklessly or using the words that you described or as you described.
Mm-hmm.
But conversations like this that focus on that tiny minority of people tend to reflect on all people with HIV. And we all agree, I think, or both you and I agree, Dan, that there are a number of things that we can do to prevent HIV in this country that are not being done. And our discussions about prevention should focus on those efforts where we can actually make progress rather than simply pointing the finger at a very small number of people with HIV.
But I don't think you can say that that small number of people isn't driving a huge number of new infections, because they are. And it's the new infections that we have to worry about. And I would argue with your point earlier that, you know, that the HIV prevention approaches are effective, because one of the things we know about the new drugs and treatment is they make people who are infected less infectious. So if we're seeing the exact same number of infections when people who are infected are on drugs and treatments that make them less infectious, we're actually therefore seeing more unsafe behavior than we were before.
There is great concern that even if this case in New York City of this HIV drug-resistant strain that was also very fast-acting, even if it turns out to be an anomaly, just one case, a lot of people think that there's going to be what they call a super virus sooner or later.
Or some other sexually transmitted disease that we don't know about yet. Yeah. You know, the emergence of a potentially fatal sexually transmitted disease is now a known consequence of unrestricted, outrageous levels of promiscuity. It happened once, it could happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question. Is that I don't understand why HIV is an infectious disease is considered different from any other infectious disease. If I have the flu, I'm asked to stay home so as not to infect anyone. If I know someone has a chicken pox and they're at home, I tell my kids, don't go over and play with them because you'll get infected. Why would it be different with HIV? It's just another infectious disease. We're discriminating against it by keeping it different.
Okay, Mike.
Mike, people don't get fired from their jobs because they have the flu or the chicken pox, and it happens every day to people with HIV all around the country.
Which is why we have laws that specifically protect people with HIV from that sort of discrimination, and we don't have those laws for the flu or for the chicken pox.
Well,
because those laws are now in place, we don't need these laws that prevent people from doing partner notification or contact tracing or sharing information.
And it's a point we've gotten to before. I just wanted to get another caller in before we have to go. Lincoln is with us in the Imperial Valley in California.
Hi, yes, I was just wondering, who are these bad gay men that supposedly have the power to go around infecting people against their will? And aren't we giving the wrong message by saying that's even possible? I mean, doesn't it take two consensual people to have sex in most of these cases, and why is one of them good and one of them bad?
Well, the law recognizes that you cannot give meaningful consent if someone withholds information about their HIV status if they're HIV positive. If somebody gives you permission to kill them, it doesn't mean you're not a murderer. It doesn't give you the right to kill them. Consent in that situation is meaningless.
Dan, I don't think that talking about people as murderers is an effective way to advance a dialogue about public health. And I'll stop there.
Okay. Lincoln?
Yes.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see if we can get one more caller in. I actually wanted to read this email that we got from Curtis. I'd liken the situation to something we do every day in the U.S., driving to work. We all know that there's risk and precautions we should take. If a person chooses not to take precautions and they're involved in an accident, are the injuries they sustain all the other driver's fault? Sex is unlike driving, as there are no witnesses to the event besides the parties involved, usually.
No,
let me finish the email. How about
I can't even not interrupt an email.
There you go. How about everyone taking responsibility for their own protection and begin to accept the outcome of risky behavior? And he says,
absolutely. People are responsible for their own choices, but people are also responsible for their, you know, negative people. People are responsible for the choice to protect themselves. People are also responsible for their choice not to protect their partners if they have HIV or any other sexually transmitted disease. You know, you can drive recklessly and get in an accident, but someone else can drive recklessly and run into you. And are they responsible? Sure, they're responsible. Mm-hmm. You were out driving. You knew there were risks. Does that mean the other person who was driving recklessly, who hit you, bears no responsibility whatsoever? Of course not.
I think we're going to wrap it up there. Appreciate your time, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
That was John Givner, and John Givner is director of the HIV Project at the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Dan Savage, editor of The Stranger, which is a weekly newspaper in Seattle. He writes the syndicated sex advice column Savage Loved, and joined us from the studios of the CBC in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where he's attending a conference. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.